Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have David Evans. David is a managing partner with Centuro Ventures. David, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So why don't we start with Centuro? Would love to know the firm's investment thesis.
Sure. So Centuro is a seed stage fund that's focused on AI enabled software. So the easiest way to think about it now, kind of as AI has become prevalent, we invest in companies that are at the application layer, utilizing artificial intelligence to solve real business problems, whether that's in e-commerce or manufacturing or distribution, looking for those companies where they're using AI to solve those real world problems.
Great. And, you know, obviously artificial intelligence has been around for a while. You know, arguably it's kind of come to the fore with OpenAI's release of ChatGPT, 2 years ago, November, 2022. So obviously there's been a material evolution. You know, would love to understand how your and the firm's perspective has changed now there's been a material proliferation of AI.
Sure. Well, ironically, the way I describe it, we launched the fund in late 2019 and really went to market with this thesis and have actually leaned in. But building deep vertical solutions is still really difficult because if you think about the data that's been used to train ChatGPT, it's largely data that's available on the internet. So when you start thinking about insurance claims data, or you start thinking about, you know, e-commerce transaction data, that's not publicly available data as part of the corpus. So the interesting opportunity for most of our companies is to be able to marry that sort of private data that's behind the scenes or that proprietary data with these public models. So it's actually made it more prevalent because what's happened is you go to ChatGPT and you get a generic answer. You can go to a portfolio company that we work with and you can get a very specific industry tailored answer. So it's actually caused us to be even more circumspect around, you know, what is the domain expertise, what is the ROI, and what is the business problem the company is solving.
Understood. So I'm going to, that makes sense. I don't want to oversimplify and put AI into two categories, at least for now. And I'll call one of them co-pilots, where they're assisting the user be more productive. And I'll put agents in the other category where you have a focus on automation. Or is Centuro focused on either one of those two use cases, or do you find you're pretty opportunistic?
So we're opportunistic. We'll look at both. We like both use cases. I think one of the challenges with agentic is simply that it's hard to build a complete solution, right? And in the co-pilot use case, you've always got sort of the human in the loop, or you're making their job easier, you're making them more efficient, you're making them faster. But they're the ultimate arbiter of success or failure. In the agentic use case, it requires a little bit more caution or in a deeper solution because you're taking the human out of the loop. You're expecting the agent to take automated action and deliver automated results. So what ends up happening on the agentic side is that we tend to require companies to have a much deeper solution than you would in the co-pilot use case.
So we're recording this in March 2025. Number of people have made a point of saying this year is a year of AI agents. Love your take. I mean, do you feel at this point in the life cycle it's more hype, or do you get the sense that there's some genuine green shoots and you're really optimistic or bullish on the segment?
I mean, I think unfortunately, I think the phrase agentic has become overused, and it really is more hype than reality. But I do think the core of the shift to agentic is really enterprises are looking for demonstrable ROI. And the challenge of the sort of co-pilot model, there's been examples of where a private equity firm has deployed a co-pilot to 20,000 employees across their portfolio, saving on average 48 minutes a day. It's a
Right.
fantastic end outcome. However, it's not 48 contiguous minutes. So it's not like I got an extra hour to my day. I had an extra 2 minutes here. I got an extra 15 minutes there. So I'm not fully newly productive with that. So it becomes hard to measure the ROI when you have that kind of squishy return and squishy value add. With agentic, I think the real core is that enterprises are pushing for that agent. I can measure exactly what the outcome is. I can measure what it took to start the process. I can measure what the net improvement was on completing the process. I can measure the improvement in throughput and all of those measurables. So I think really underpinning this whole movement is that notion of generating measurable ROI as much as it is about having this autonomous agent that goes off and does whatever you'd like it to.
So said another way, it sounds like we're in early innings, but there's promise. In the meantime, I heard you reference e-commerce. Are there any industries or sub-industries that in particular that you're bullish on at the moment?
So we tend to like the we call it the jobs not being done. It's places where they've historically been under-resourced and underinvested. So think about things like compliance and human resources. A lot of your sort of cost centers within an organization, the work isn't getting fully done anyway, right? Or it's not you're not fully dedicating the resources that you need because it's not cost effective. It doesn't generate more sales. It doesn't lower costs of your organization, but it's important work that needs to get done. We're excited about those types of opportunities because it's work that needs to get done that's not being done. It's not going to take anyone's job away. It's actually a place where companies will realize the benefit of being better in their HR processes, being better in their compliance processes, being better in their recruitment processes. You'll realize the benefit of it, but you're not going to have that sort of trade-off of, are we letting people go or are we reinventing the wheel? Like it's something we can hand off for automation pretty easily.
That makes good sense because as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking it's not controversial. You shouldn't run into a lot of friction because you're talking about improving people's lives versus displacing them. Bunch more questions on Sensera before we do. Would love to learn a little bit more about your background. I know you've been an entrepreneur. I know you are have been an angel investor. What was your career trajectory leading up to today?
Sure. So the way I generally describe it is that I'm a technologist, entrepreneur, and investor in that order. I started coding at 14 years old on a TI-85 graphing calculator. I started my first business when I was 19 years old, my second at 22, after having gone to work for a dot-com that failed during the dot-com bubble, and started my third business that I sold about 10 years ago, started that in 2005.
Yes.
I dabbled in angel investing in the call it 2010, 2011 timeframe. At that time, I was running two businesses, which if you're going to be an investor and do it properly in private markets and especially early stage startups, it's not the best idea to do it when you have zero free time. It takes a lot of time, a lot of work. Being an angel investor is just as much work as being a venture investor. So I dabbled in it in the 2010s, but once I sold EasySeat in 2015, we sold to a strategic, so I didn't have a long earnout. I didn't have a lot of involvement with the company. I got involved in angel investing again. And what I realized is exactly what I just described, is that it's a lot of work and it can be a full-time job. If you're going to generate quality deal flow, if you're going to find quality deals and you're going to do adequate due diligence, it's a full-time job. And being an entrepreneur, I don't like doing full-time jobs without creating a business around it. So I got involved with first got involved with a fund here in Dallas called RevTech Ventures that was focused on retail technology. Kind of cut my teeth in venture capital working with David and the team at RevTech, but decided in 2019, sort of that background in tech and that history in tech and being sort of a tech nerd at heart. I was realizing that we were starting to see AI be delivered to the enterprise in a meaningful way, and thought it was time to focus my time and energy on the technology rather than the industry. And that's sort of where Sentiero was born in 2019, and we're now on our second fund. And you know, we got it, we were early to market in AI, and you know, we still think that we hold strong opinions and deep technical roots that help us invest in it.
Fantastic. So if we can start unpacking your experience as an entrepreneur, sounds like you're in a great position because you have a combination of success and then not a great outcome. How's that informed how you evaluate businesses today?
Sure. So one of the things that we look at when it comes to evaluating businesses, really, it's a one foot in front of the other process, right? It's you go from 0 to a million to 5 million, 5 million to $10 million, but you don't sort of skip steps in the middle. And there's this common misconception in venture capital that you somehow just wake up one day and you're $100 million a year company. While that does happen, you do have your edge cases like OpenAI. Of the thousands of companies that are successfully venture funded every year, they follow that one foot in front of the other process. And that's no different than being a bootstrapped entrepreneur and building any company from the ground up, is that every day you wake up and you work on taking that next step and moving the company forward. Really, the only difference with venture capital is that maybe instead of walking those steps and, you know, sort of crawl, walk, run, we can accelerate the rate of progression of crawl, walk, run, and maybe we can run a little bit faster with venture capital and venture backing. So, but we still fundamentally believe your goal as a venture-backed business is to build a great company that stands on its own using capital to accelerate that process.
And so, I think having spoken to a lot of entrepreneurs and founders, I think the appreciation is increasing, but they don't necessarily think that once you raise money, the work just begins, versus saying, "Hey, I now have cash in the bank. Let me think about what I'm going to do next." But on the contrary, so that said, is there a certain profile or characteristics of founders that either you hone in on or just unequivocally, you think are integral to success?
Oh, absolutely. So for our thesis and our profile, it's always mandatory that founders have experience in the vertical market that they serve. So if you're going to sell to the manufacturing industry, we want to see you have experience in the manufacturing industry, because that's the only way you truly understand the problem from a 360 degree perspective. You can't in most industries be an outsider and solve the problem. You have to be an insider. The other thing is we do look for founders that have entrepreneurial experience. And I don't care if it's a venture-backed startup. I don't care if it was a lemonade stand when you were in middle school. But we want founders that have had that experience of being the end-all be-all, being the desk where the buck stops, having to generate sales, having to deal with the entirety of the process, because it saves you a little bit of learning on the job. No matter what you read, how many podcasts you listen to, it's still going to be a bit of a learning experience as an entrepreneur. You know, I've started and exited. Technically, you can count Sentiero as at least my fifth business over the course of the last 30 years. And I'm still going to learn and make mistakes with every new business that I start and that I work on. So we want people that have already made some of those mistakes, so hopefully that they can avoid them in the future. But it's not mandatory, right? Like we want that entrepreneurial mindset, but it's not something that we have that's a mandatory requirement.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to argue that if you have familiarity with the industry that you're operating in, then you're going to have, a whole host of perspectives that an outsider would. So makes complete and total sense. Also, though, curious, given your experience, but then also looking at a lot of companies, what pitfalls in particular do you see either a lot of founders make, or that you are just very preemptive and say, hey, don't, I highly recommend not doing this?
I mean, it's the mistake I made early on with my software company. And it's not listening to your market and not understanding what your customers want and not being in front of customers early in the process. It's very easy. Now, the flip side to that, I've been in the industry and I have that expertise. The flip side to that is a little bit of arrogance and maybe a little bit of Dunning-Kruger. Early on in my career, we built a SaaS product for the secondary ticketing industry. That was the industry that I was in during the dot-com boom. So I thought I knew the industry. I was there to build software, and instead of building it inside a company, I was doing it as a vendor to the industry. So I went away for 18 months, and we went and we built a product. On my very first sales call, I'm describing the product, and they said, "That's great, but we don't have access to the internet. Here, I've got a SaaS product," and this is early 2000s. You had customers that didn't have persistent access to the internet. It's an extreme example, but it's a good microcosm of what can happen if you don't stay close to your customers as you build your product. And don't assume that because you know the industry or that you have a first pilot customer or a design partner that you've got all the answers. The product is going to grow and change rapidly over the first 24 to 36 months of the life cycle before you find product market fit. And it's not what you believe, it's what your customers will pay for and find value in.
Right. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. When I find myself in these conversations, I'll go so far as to say, hey, before you spend a dollar on product development, go talk to your potential buyers, describe what you have, and ask them if they give you money for it. Because if they wouldn't, you need to rethink what problem you think that you're solving. All right, so let's come back to Centuro. Would love to know to the degree that the firm gets involved with supporting its portfolio companies.
No, absolutely. I think it's one of the oversold cliches in venture is that we're helpful. Myself and my two partners, we've all gone the zero to one. We've all built, scaled, and exited companies, and we understand that we are there to be an advisory resource. We're there to be a referral partner. We're there to be someone to lean on. But at the end of the day, the work is to be done by our founding teams, right? The founders and the early team are the ones that get up in the morning and think about their company and think about the problem they're working on and go to bed at night thinking about the problem they're working on and thinking about the company. As a venture investor, I've got dozens of those companies in my portfolio. Doesn't mean that I don't think about them. Doesn't mean I don't want to help them. But, the way we can help best is to be an advisor, to provide input, to provide feedback, to provide them with some of the lessons that we've learned over 30 years of entrepreneurship, because both my partners have sort of a similar timeline with entrepreneurship. So that's really where we try to help is we talk to all of our CEOs at least on a monthly basis. And if they're deep in the weeds of an acquisition or, a product pivot or, going through a key hire, we want to be there. And we want to be their first call as an advisor to help them when they need it, when they feel like they need that, when they feel like they need that help. But I don't like to ever say that or claim that we do much of anything other than advise, simply because no matter what it is, it's on the teams to do the work.
So pre or post investment then, are there any metrics that the firm will use to assess viability and progress?
Yeah, so we generally invest pretty early, so we don't use a lot of metrics. You don't have a clearly defined customer acquisition cost or lifetime value yet, just because of the age of the company. But we do look for is exactly one of the things that you described is we want to see customers voting with their wallets. Now, I don't care specifically of for a floor on a revenue number, but I want to see that team can take their product, bring it to market, acquire a lead and bring that lead all the way through the sales funnel and convert them to a customer. If you're dealing with enterprise software, it may be perfectly fine for us to have one customer that does that because the enterprise sales cycle is long and it's involved and you've only got a small team. If it's traditional SaaS, that's a smaller revenue figure, we want to see more of the shape of the go-to-market funnel starting to come together, right? Can you consistently put leads in the top of the funnel and can you consistently have a percentage of those come out the bottom of the funnel? But we don't have any fixed numbers or metrics that go about it, other than we want to see customers voting with their wallets.
You mentioned, and so with that, you mentioned product market fit, arguably the holy grail for an early stage company to achieve. As you reflect back on your experience, your time with Sincero, is there a profile or characteristics in the evolution of a team and its product to get closer to product market fit?
I mean, I think the to steal the quote from Jason Lemkin today, is the you've got product market fit when you don't know where the customers are coming from. You know, when you're early in the life cycle, when you're early in the life cycle of the business, you know exactly how you got the lead, you know exactly the process you took them through, you remember all the conversations, all of the negotiation. And when you've got product market fit, it just kind of happens, right? Like you've got process and structure and what have you. And we have a similar thing at Sentiero of where I couldn't specifically tell you how we generate all of our inbound leads for companies because it's the culmination of a long process of kind of developing product, developing services, developing messaging and go-to-market strategy. And the same thing happens with companies is that, you know, you sort of know product market fit when you have it, but I love that measure of, you know, when you look at the customers that came in and you're just like, they just appeared. They found us or, you know, they got referred to us.
And so build on that. Our firm provides accounting and finance services to early stage companies. And as fractional CFOs, one of the conversations we find ourselves in is allocating budget between product development and sales and marketing. I've participated in conversations where founders feel really strong about investing in features and functions, and that'll attract new clients. Then founders, you're like, I can have the best product on the face of the planet, but if the world doesn't know about it, it's inconsequential. We'd love to know your perspective. In the spirit of not knowing where your clients are coming from, is that, do you feel like that's more you've actually built a best-in-class product, or you've built something that's, I don't want to say good enough, but really good enough? And we just got to make sure the world knows about it.
Well, I think it's that latter category, right? Where you're talking about we've built something that's good enough. You know, I steal a quote from my partner John, in because he'll use it quite frequently with our portcos, is you've built the thing, people are buying the thing, find more people that will buy that thing. Because the insight there is that a lot of times what we tend to do is we tend to look past the people that are already paying us, right? And you go and you look and you realize that, well, there's a customer set, we've got 30 customers and they all have a particular profile. Well, how many people or companies are there in the world that have that same profile? And the notion there is if there's 1,000 companies in the world that have that profile, how about you try going after those 1,000 companies? Because there's a pretty good probability that you don't need to add a single feature to go after those 1,000 companies. Now, it's not to be said that you don't continue to invest in product development, but if you've got that kind of momentum and you've got that shape of a go-to-market funnel, you know, it's best to lean into that growth and do more of what's working rather than looking at new product development, hoping that those new features work.
You mentioned Jason Lemkin, shout out to Sasser. I remember reading something he said once about the progression of sales within an early stage company. Starts with the founder, And until which time there's a degree of predictability with the top of your funnel and closing deals, it becomes appropriate to hire account executives and eventually a VP of sales. I'm curious though, I've also now more recently heard conversations that there's no two ways about it. Founder must absolutely remain involved with sales because they're going to be the absolute biggest advocate for the company, regardless of its size. Curious your perspective.
So I think I would agree with that. Founders are going to be a part of sales essentially into perpetuity. There's stories. I've known some folks that worked at Oracle, and 20 years into the life of Oracle, if they were pitching a big account, Larry Ellison would be on the sales call. Like, he would be part of that process. But your role changes, right? Early on as your founder, or early on as a founder, it's about discovery. Part of that sales process, understanding what the objections are, understanding maybe what are the features that competitors are pitching that you need to consider to add, or maybe what are the differences in process that a competitor is using, or how can we better interface with our customer? There's still a little bit of early product development as a in founder-led sales, and a little bit of sort of organizational development that goes on. As you evolve later, it becomes more about sort of brand reputation and trust, in giving those prospects and giving those customers the assurance that you're going to be there to support them, and as well as your team, that you're going to be there to sell and support them. Larry Ellison wasn't going on those sales calls because he was making a bunch of cold calls. He was there precisely to give that level of confidence that the account was going to be taken care of. And it's no different with your startup.
I think it's a great example. Dave, it's been a great podcast. Appreciate sharing your insights. One of the questions I'd love to wrap up with is if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
That one's a loaded one because I think I have different ones for every company, right? I think with my software company, I gave you the example of building software without engaging customers early. We lost a first mover advantage because we didn't do that, right? We went away and we built. Rather than working with our customers, getting to an early prototype, a proof of concept that we got in the market, we lost 18 months of cycle time. And by the time we were able to catch up to our mistakes, we had three competitors in the market that had caught up to us. With EDC, I think I was myopic about it. I didn't think I needed or wanted to raise capital. And in reality, I probably should have. With that business, is incredibly capital intensive, and I shut out the possibility of raising capital because I'm like, oh, we're not a fundable business. But there's a dozen companies that have raised capital in that industry that have had really solid outcomes with the capital. So those are just two, but that's part of what we try to do with our portfolio founders is share with them some of those life lessons of, hey, here's some of the things that may not have worked out the way we expected them to, but hopefully you can avoid making the same mistake all over again.
That's great advice. David, if there are any founders, co-investors, potential LPs who want to connect with you, how can they find you?
So, I'm super active on LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out to me there. I'm active on Twitter as well. It's at Compulsive Start. And also just simply via email, david@centiro.vc.
Great. David, thank you so much for being on the podcast. David Evans, Managing Partner, Centiro Ventures. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, Founder and CEO of Finchrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode.
Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.